You are now tuned into CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Want to know more about the channel? Find us online at cjsf.ca.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
Days of planetary polycrises, I'm finding that I'm turning more and more toward poetry. More than the torrent of data and information that is coming from an increasingly polarized and rageful culture, it's poetry that's enlivening my heart. It's poetry that takes me to a grander landscape and leads me to the wholeness of things. It helps me to stand from a vantage point that includes wonder and awe. It can also reveal this broader landscape without denying the dangers and the challenges humanity faces. And that will be our subject today with our guest, award-winning poet Jane Hirschfield. Jane Hirschfield is the author of 10 books of poetry and 2 collections of essays, and has created and co-translated 4 books presenting the work of world poets from the past. A resident of Northern California, she is a Chancellor Emerita of the Academy of American Poets. In 2017, Hirschfield organized Poets for Science component for the Maine, Washington, D.C. March for Science, held January 24, 2017, in protest for the removal of scientific information from federal agency websites. She has curated an interactive exhibit of science poems and writings housed at Kent State's Wick Poetry Center, which has traveled to venues across the country. Her most recent book of poetry is entitled The Asking, New and Selected Poems. I'm speaking with Jane Hirschfield at her home in Northern California by remote connection. Join us for the next hour as we explore how living language of poetry enlivens us in dark times with our guest, Jane Hirschfield. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Jane, welcome once more to New Dimensions.
Oh, thank you, Justine. What you said was so beautiful about why we might need to turn to poetry in these times. And, you know, I almost just feel as if I should sit back for the next hour and let you just talk. But I'm delighted to represent the art form for this hour for our listeners.
Oh, excellent. I am so glad you're up for it, because I have just been immersing myself in your poetry for, you know, several weeks now, and it's just like on my heart, and I'm so excited to talk to you. And what I want to do is to start off with a poem. And the poem that I chose to start off with is called 10. And to help our listeners understand it, that's not the number 10. It's like the metal 10, T-I-N. So I would love for you, first of all, to read the poem, and then I'd love for us to talk about it.
Of course. 10. I studied much and remembered little, but the world is generous. It kept offering figs and cheeses. Never mind that soon I'll have to give it all back. The world, the figs. To be a train station of existence is no small matter. It doesn't need to be Grand Central or Haider Pasha Station. The engine shed could be low, windowed with coal dust under a slat shingled roof. It could be tin. Another mystery bandaged with rivets and rubies, leaking cold and heat in both directions, as the earth does.
I'm just riveted by this poem. You take us on such a journey on it. First of all, when you talk about the train stations, you talk about the Grand Central. And when you talk about the Haider Pasha Station, if people need to look that up and Google it, it's this huge, ornate building in Istanbul. And then it goes down to this slat shingled roof. It could be tin. And Jane, when I read that, and when I reread that, because I read it more than once, which is wonderful to do with poetry, is to read it more than once and let it sink in. But it took me, I must say, to Africa. That was the first place I went, and I could see the images of many people who lived in these slanted roof tin shelters. Then the next lines, you put two words together. You put bandaged with rivets and rubies. And then you took us out into the whole earth. And I thought of the earth, the breath of the earth. So I just wanted to share with you why I picked that poem. It's not a long poem, but it contains so much. I would love to ask you to reveal to me or talk about this poem for you.
Yes. Well, you know, for me, writing any poem is always an act of discovery. I never know what I'm going to say. The poem begins to speak, and it tells me things. I feel like writing is as much an act of listening as it is of conducting or composing. Some inner voice begins to speak and shows me what it is I'm thinking about that I didn't yet know I was thinking about until the words arrive. And I love your appreciation of this poem, because it is trying to see the full range of why existence is so amazing. And, you know, the turning sentence of it was one that you didn't repeat, which was, to be a train station of existence is no small matter.
I loved it.
And that just surprised me when it arrived, you know. But it feels to me really true. Our lives are both large and small. They are both grand and filled with the humility of knowing what a tiny cog we are in the great machinery of all being, and yet each cog essential. And so both the humility and the grandeur of whatever architecture our lives are giving us in any given moment, be it, you know, so many of us have passed through Grand Central Station, and it is in a way a sacred space. You know, the architecture, the height of the roof, the constellations that are worked into it as you know, as the imagery above your head. And meanwhile, you're down there, you know, with all of the commuters, and perhaps you're on your way to work, or maybe you've got a, you know, rolling piece of luggage that you're hoping nobody's going to not notice and trip over. to find Haider Pasha Station, I wanted the combination of something not in America was very important to me. And then it had to be, you know, the equal of Grand Central in some totally different diction of existence. And so, of course, these days you can go online to do your research and, you know, you enter into the search engine, you know, great train stations of the world. And I considered many, but the name of it really mattered, and that it be, as it turned out to be, not so familiar, but such a marvelous thing to say. I had to, again, you know, go online into the how to pronounce site to make sure I was saying it correctly. But it is a magnificent station. And, you know, Istanbul is certainly as much the center of the world as New York City is. And then from that, once I had written, you know, it doesn't need to be Grand Central or Haider Pasha Station. You know, it could be this tiny shack of a minor location. I did see the tin as, you know, this is a train station. It's a little siding place where, you know, maybe the engine might need a little bit of working on or whatever. And so the whole poem is this marriage of contrasts and the two ends of the spectrum of what is the most delicious and radiant and transcendent, and also what is the most daily and particular and intimate. You know, figs and cheeses. Both of those are extraordinary flavors. They are intense and dense, but they are available. I have a fig tree in my garden. You know, it is, the whole poem is just trying to take in what does it feel like to be a human being in this world? And so that very opening sentence, I studied much and remembered little. You know, it's like, this is my life. It has been so broad. And yet we take only these, what is T.S. Eliot's old phrase, these fragments I have shored against my ruin. Whatever memories we carry, they are tiny shards of a life, and any life is a tiny shard of the shared life of existence of which we are part. And all of that was what this poem was trying to say thank you to, fundamentally. Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to live in this world, which has rivets, you know, repairing the broken, repairing the fractured, and rubies, you know, found glorious bits of gorgeousness buried in rock for billions of years and somehow come to the surface and available for us to take in the gleam of.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And I think our listeners can feel what it's like to embody, to allow the body to receive a poem.
Yes.
I want us to really be able to talk about that in more length. But do you have a note to give us on listening with the body?
Well, I think that it is the very nature of poetry to always summon from its writer, from its reader, from its listener, the quality of embodied wisdom.
Exactly. And I want you to go further, more deeply into that in just one moment. But I want to remind our listeners, I'm here with Jane Hirschfield, and her newest book of poetry is The Asking, New and Selected Poems. I'm so excited about this book. You have so much in there. And I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
Thank you.
I'm here with poet, award-winning poet, Jane Hirschfield, and we've been together quite a few times now, and I'm always so glad to have her on, especially now. And we're talking about how to receive a poem, and I was suggesting that it could be allowing our body to receive a poem rather than going through the analytical mind. Do you have any thoughts on that, Jane?
Yeah, so most of our intellect, all of our intellect, is built on embodied experience. If you look at the etymology of any word in the language, however abstract it seems, take the word abstract. Within that word is the old verb root having to do with pulling. It is a physical word. All of our thinking is made out of the shared experience that came from pre-languaged existence. Where else could you draw it from? Where else could language have been invented from except being these embodied creatures who came into the world and somehow developed the gift of expression, of naming, of saying, of communicating, of calling. Now, this is a continuum from the animals. I don't think we're exceptional. I think I have a friend who's trying to figure out, you know, how can we learn to understand better the cries of the non-human world, the calls, the songs, the ecstasies. And, you know, maybe they'll solve it. I hope so, because wouldn't we treat animals better if we understood how sophisticated they actually are inside their own lives as fully as us? But, you know, to take in a poem is also an experience of your connection with everything the poem evokes. And so if you're going to understand a shed or a ruby or a fig in a poem, you do that with your entire life's relationship and knowledge to these things. Life would be so thin if we didn't bring our entire experience into it. And so also comes, you know, the grief of transience, the exuberance of, you know, this sort of cartwheeling of the world and its gorgeousness. All of these things, we feel them in our body. We only know through our body. Now, a conversation you and I are not going to have is about why AI can't actually write a good poem. And, you know, I think a great deal of that has to do with the fact that an AI does not have a body. It neither feels what it is saying nor feels what it is drawing from.
Wow, that's profound. That's one of the best arguments I've heard for so far. It's very interesting you bring that up, Jane, because in poetry, often you help us pay attention to very small things. And it reminds me, I'm preparing the next interview I'll be doing will be with a guest who I've had on before, Hirsch Wilson. His book was called Firefighter Zen. He's a volunteer firefighter and wonderful man. And his newest book is called Dog Lessons. And he works with lots of dogs. He suggests that when we walk our dogs, we are walking them down maybe a pathway that we've been down hundreds of times. Yet this dog, it's a new experience every single time. It finds some little something new and gets all excited about this little newness. And so I feel that your poetry take us from the micro, and then it oftentimes ends up in the macro. And one of those poems that I think takes us there, it's called Mosses.
Yes.
And I would love for you to read to us that poem, Mosses.
Happily. This poem came from a special feature that was in the New York Times and can be found about the discovery of these mosses. And it has the most beautiful photographs and images in it. I commend it to people to search it out. mosses. And here's the epigraph from the story. In the Mojave Desert, a translucent crystal offers bryophytes much needed respite from the heat of the sun. Now, that's already a poem in itself. So anyhow, that was in the Times, July 29th, 2020. And I knew immediately I was going to write about it. It took me such a long time to both write this poem and then find an ending for it. Much longer than usual. But here is how it finally came out in Scientific American, which just delights me that since I am a poet who is very engaged with the marriage of the imagination and the sciences, I just love that I had a poem in Scientific American. Mosses. For hypolithic mosses, it seems, 4% of daylight is right. They live, the headline says, by sheltering under a parasol of translucent quartz. The crystal scatters the light's ultraviolet, dilutes its heat, traps the night's condensed moisture to moss-sized rain. I think of these mosses and consider. Perhaps we too are mosses, evolving to the parch of our self-made Mojaves. Unable to bear the full brightness, the full seeing, to recognize fully the Amazon burning, the Arctic burning, the monarch's smoke-colored missing migration. An experiment not meant to last, and yet we found shelter within it. We pondered our lives and the lives of others, thirsted, slept, to the implausible green of existence, for better, for worse, we offered our 4% portion of praises. For better, for worse, our 4% portion of comprehension.
Yeah, we ponder our lives and the lives of others at the implausible green of existence. Yeah, you take us to these tiny little moss sheltered under this crystal and getting a little bit of moisture. And here we are in our lives. And yet we are part of this kinship of all life.
Yes. And the recognition, I think, of that kinship is what will allow us, if we do, to change our course and allow our species and all other species to move forward in time into a viable biosphere, into a world where we who are so fragile, as those mosses are so fragile, might live, might continue to live. And, you know, it might be, I've never quite made this part of the poem conscious before because one doesn't analyze one's own poems so much. But, you know, maybe the analogy to that desert quartz, which shelters the mosses from just baking and drying up in the sun and dying, maybe our human analogy to that could be thought of as our sense of kinship and connection, our love for what we are part of. And this poem, like many, many of my poems increasingly over the years, was written in the awareness of the possibility of extinction. You know, the climate crisis and the crisis of toxins and of waste and of destruction. You know, it's not only climate change. There are many ways we damage the earth by our rather thoughtless extravagance and unthinking enjoyment of what, you know, modernity has brought us. I never want in my poems to point a finger and condemn, because that is not the path to any solution. It just makes people either frightened or aggravated or throws them into despair, which is equally disastrous. You can touch despair. I think despair is very, I'm sorry, I'm sort of going off on a tangent here.
This is an important tangent, though,
yeah,
please.
Yeah,
So people have different relationships to despair. And some of my friends think it is terribly important that especially young people not experience it because it is so undoing. And I have a slightly different understanding of despair, which is, for me, despair is the thing that when you feel it, and I do feel it quite regularly, as, you know, the barrage of news enters my awareness, but it is so unbearable that despair for me is a spur towards countering it, towards answering it, towards finding a way past it. Despair is not for me what might be called clinical depression. Despair for me is a glimpse of something that I know is intolerable, unbearable. And so it causes me to work all the harder towards a future, you know, far beyond and past my own small life. It is a spur. And so I do not want to not experience anything. You know, the old sentence from the Roman Terence, nothing human is foreign to me. I want to experience everything that human beings experience. But the dance of spiritual practice and of resilience asks of us in part to recognize that none of these things is a permanent condition, that everything changes. And in any moment, it is perhaps our task as a human still able to put your own molecule of intention onto the tiller of the world, to move toward the good, to move toward the sense of shared fate, to move toward gratitude, to move toward hope. And I do think this is possible. And the worse the moment is, you know, that black moment when you just feel like, will I be able to bear witnessing the next 25 years, which is about how long I expect to remain on this planet if I follow the family genetics. And, you know, what will we see as we make this transition from one way of being on this planet to another? And there's no promises. Human beings have lived through the worst many times. And I found myself very quickly, I found myself in my car a couple of months ago, suddenly blurting out of the blue, I will outlive this.
Oh, I love that.
I will outlive this.
Thank you, Jane. I'm here with Jane Hirschfield, and we're talking about how poetry can help us in these despairing times, so to speak. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile.